To summarize that kind of sentiment, I heard this both from you and from Gerald when I was considering this, because one of my main reservations was like, moving a family, maybe this would have made sense when it was just Shelby and me. But what Gerald said, I remember, was it won't make any more sense 2 years from now, or 3 years from now, or 5 years from now. So yes, it sounds hard, but it's not going to get easier in the future. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Pastor Theologians Podcast. We are continuing, Todd and I, our conversation from the last 2 weeks today. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to those episodes, I encourage you to go back and give it a listen, and we're going to pick up where we left off last time. The entirety of the program oftentimes, far more often than not, is simply to, not simply, but to do your research and write your thesis is the extent of the PhD program. And having already completed two MAs, that seems like a good option for me.
Yeah.
But then in conversation with you, I sent out some feelers. Some people were open to it, but several potential advisors that I had reached out to said, hey, this topic sounds great, but if you want to do this, I would strongly encourage you to move here and study at the university. Some people, for instance, would say, yeah, this university does allow for part-time distance students, but for my supervision, I prefer to not do that. So I should just say up front that this isn't going to be an option. And at that point, really what I was looking to, if I wanted to study what I wanted to study, I was looking at a second or even third tier program. And I remember distinctly one time we were talking in my office at the CPT office at the time, and you just said, Zach, do you want to do this? And I said, yeah, I think I do. He's like, okay, well, if you're going to do it, you really ought to move there. And you really should apply at the top tier institutions and with top tier advisors. See what happens if you don't settle for a different type of experience and see what doors God opens. So I don't know if you want to comment on that now.
But that was the advice. It obviously resonated with you.
It did. It was very intimidating at the time to consider, like, oh my gosh, moving, and oh my gosh, that would be so expensive, and I've never moved, and leaving everything we have here. We love our life here. We love our community here. That was very scary for a while, for sure. But I don't know. Do you want to unpack what was behind that advice you gave me?
Yeah, there are a number of things. I mean, this is always a case by case. You know, the advice that I would give would always be case by case and get to know a person, their gifts, their passions, their life situation, what they want to do vocationally. I mean, it's a complex decision, but I think a combination of things for you were that you were academically wired and gifted enough to apply and in all likelihood get in. So that was just a sort of a starting point, I thought. And you had the appetite and energy to do well in an Oxford sort of setting, which candidly, that wouldn't be everybody's cup of tea. So that was part of it. And I also got the sense that where you were life stage, you might be able to pull it off with Shelby. It sounded like she was open to the possibility. So that was important. And you weren't getting any younger, and I wasn't getting, none of us are getting any younger. And so you were 27, I think, at the time when we started having this conversation.
Yeah.
And with each
passing year, another on the way.
That's right. And with each passing year, I think it's the case that this sort of thing gets harder and harder. The advice I got back as an undergrad was get as much education as you can, and the best education you can, as fast as you can. Right. And that won't be everybody. I mean, that is, for some listeners, that might strike them as not good advice. I found it to be sensible advice. And that was sort of the way my own life unfolded, and was good, so that I was done with PhD at the age of 29 back here, yes. You know, and being able to take up something full time.
Which is amazingly young to be done with a PhD, really. I mean, it's physically possible to get it done sooner, but really that's fast.
Yes, right. No, that's right. That's right. And so that served me well, I think. And then we could start really, you know, leaning. I mean, we had a child when we went to England, and then we had a second when we were there, and we were pregnant with the third when we came back. So it wasn't as though we put all of that on hold. But it was, you know, you've got far more flexibility at that age and with that level of commitments than, you know, let's say my kids are in junior high and high school and I'm trying to start this. That just would have been impossible.
To summarize that kind of sentiment, I heard this both from you and from Gerald when I was considering this, because one of my main reservations was like, moving a family, maybe this would have made sense when it was just Shelby and me. But what Gerald said, I remember, was it won't make any more sense 2 years from now.
Yes,
3 years from now, or
5 years.
That's
a nice way to put it.
And it will make more sense now than it ever will in the future. It will be easier to do now than it ever. So yes, it sounds hard, but it's not going to get easier in the future.
That's right.
Move and do that with the family. And that was decisive, realizing like, okay, well, if I'm going to do this, I should strike while the iron is hot. In this case, meaning that my master's education isn't too far in the rearview mirror and my kids are young. That was important.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I just one last thing I would say is some people can do very well and make the most of doing a PhD or a master's degree for that matter, part-time. Some people can do that. And some people have to do that. They don't have any other options, right? And they're gonna leverage their opportunities and make the most of it. And that's great. But I don't think, and maybe I'm going to overstate this a little bit, I just don't think you can compete with being full-time, fully immersed on location in the university context, up to your eyeballs in the research and the relationships and the atmosphere and all the rest of it, that you can't compete with that as a learning opportunity, as a learning experience. And if one can get that, right? So go residential to Gordon Conwell and be there for 3 years doing an MDiv, let's say, or go for 3 years to Cambridge and do a PhD and live there and be a part of the environment and soak up the faculty for all that you know, so on. That's the best way, I think, to do the education, because education, of course, is more than just dabbling in the books and writing the thesis. I mean, it's the whole sort of formative community that is so significant, and the exposure it gives you and so on. And one more thing to say about that is, I also think it would be very difficult to make an original contribution to scholarship, which is the purpose of a PhD. A PhD is not a credential. A PhD is to make an original contribution to scholarship. That's why they award PhDs, or at least that's why they should award PhDs. And I don't know that you can do that by, you know, cramming in your PhD work for 3 or 4 weeks in the summer and, you know, jamming in some Saturday mornings while you're doing your full-time job. And I mean, there are some rare human beings who,
and we know some of them, by the way.
And we know some of them. That's right. But in terms of really producing a publishable piece of scholarship that is serious, I don't know how you can do that without going somewhere and immersing yourself in the waters for 3 years where this is all you're doing. I don't know how you can do that. And I sense that you have that capacity and appetite Going back to the beginning of your story, Zach, of intellectual curiosity, that's one of the things I often talk when I talk to people and give them advice. I say, how intellectually curious are you? Right? I mean, I might not put it exactly that way, but I will say, how did you do in school? And I'm looking for in that, you know, I'm looking for not just how did they perform in terms of competency and capacity, but also did they love it? Did they have an appetite for it? Because man, it's glamorous to sort of go to Oxford and do a DPhil until you get there and you're 6 months into it or 16 months into it. And there's no end in sight. And you're utterly lost in the Bodleian Library trying to figure out what on earth you're going to research. And you're thinking, have I made a grand mistake here? And this is costing me tens of thousands of dollars and I'm completely lost. And I don't know that I'm ever going to finish. I mean, that you got to have some drive and an appetite and some capacity if you're going to make that kind of commitment. And I saw you as having that sort of drive and earnestness and capacity. And that was part of, so I've taken too long to explain what was in my head, but that was what was in my head. How did you choose Oxford, by the way, Zach? Talk to us about that, because you had other options. You could have chosen, you know, stateside or schools, and I think you had another UK option that was available to you.
Yeah. How did you choose Oxford? I mean, we had talked about, when we were framing up this conversation, we had talked about kind of doing a compare and contrast potentially between, you know, state schools or US universities or UK universities or, you know, evangelical seminaries here in the US. Perhaps we can, that'd be a interesting and fun conversation that we could have later. For me, I'll just say briefly, the fact that I had already completed two MAs, made the, US, university model less attractive, because PhD programs here are often 6, 7 years or longer.
And they're taught, right? I mean, our listeners, many of them will already understand this, but they're a taught rather than a research driven. They're you know, a couple of years of coursework followed by comprehensive exams, then the thesis.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And like I say, we can talk kind of more about that compare and contrast. But like, for instance, I looked a little bit at like Notre Dame, but it was going to be so long. I would have been pushing 40 by the time I finished this thing. Then I thought, well, what about something local, like an evangelical school like Wheaton or like, TEDS for example. And, having already had spent so much time in Chicago and at evangelical institutions, not, you know, I consider myself an evangelical. I plan to, you know, go study at Oxford as a confessing evangelical, but, in terms of education, I've explored that horizon and I kind of want to broaden a bit, which gets back to your intellectual curiosity point. So the UK model, which is typically 3 years, sometimes four, where you're just doing the research and there's not a taught component, although opportunities are available to you.
Yes.
Seemed like a good fit for me. So that was decisive. And then I applied to, three programs. To Cambridge, to Oxford, and to Durham, which just felt very, I mean, it felt like the best programs I could apply to in the UK.
Yes.
For New Testament and studying Paul, which I want to do. I was accepted at Durham and was accepted at Oxford and was actually rejected at Cambridge, which I know, Todd, you were very disappointed about.
I was. I advocated for you, Zach. I appreciate that.
But it actually made my decision.
Zach, you deserve to be rejected because you were on the fence about if you got into all the schools, which one you'd go to. And I kept saying you should absolutely go to Cambridge and you weren't so sure. Well, I'm glad they rejected you.
A little bit. It made my decision easier for sure. Because I was leaning a little bit towards Oxford, but we visited Cambridge and loved it. So that would have been difficult. But I was grateful. Really what became Marcus Bachmiel, who is the person I applied to study with at Oxford, is a world-class top-tier scholar. And the opportunity to study with him is not something I wanted to pass on. which is by no means a slight to John Barclay, who I was no one would dare slight John Barclay.
Those are the two great British. Marcus yes. is not Brit, not British, but the two great serving in the UK New Testament scholars. Two preeminent New Testament scholars in my humble opinion.
So I was thrilled at the opportunity to study with either of them. What was decisive in our case was that Oxford is just a little bit closer, more than a little bit. It's close to London, which makes it then in turn closer to the United States. And it's a more urban environment, which we're used to having lived in Oak Park just outside of Chicago for a while. It just felt like a better fit for our family.
Briefly, how did you choose your topic, Zach? I know our listeners, some of them are in the throes of trying to figure out what they're going to, submit with their application and proposal thesis topic. How did you choose your topic and any advice there before we land?
Perhaps one thing I'll say is that I want to do something on reward and recompense in the Apostle Paul, particularly reward or payment for believers in at the coming of Christ is something I'm hoping to do some research on. What was decisive for me in kind of moving forward through the proposal process with that topic is that I had been interested and curious about it for years, and it kind of had never gone away in my head.
Right.
Like I'd been thinking about it since I think as early as first year in my exegesis degree, definitely about the second year of my exegesis degree.
Yes.
I was kind of asking some pretty serious questions, and having gone to Moody and which is a dispensational school, 1 Corinthians 3 and the kind of dispensational theological structure that they is put around that, with the Bema Seat judgment and believers being judged according to their works, but only for rewards, and non-believers being judged according to their faith or lack thereof in Christ. And all of those things were interesting to me, and I wanted to try to do something on that. So when, 5 years down the line, when I was applying to PhD programs, I was like, I've always been curious about this, and I've read a decent amount and have not quite found something that satisfies me as an answer on these questions that I have. That was a good indicator to me that, well, if I've read a decent bit and I don't quite like what everyone's saying about it, maybe I could do some research myself and have something to say about it. And if I've been interested in it and curious about it for 5 years, hopefully that curiosity will be enough to sustain me for the 3 years of doing research on that topic. And all of this with a huge asterisk that maybe I'll get there in a few months in, this kind of research trajectory will dry up and I'll have to do something completely different. You never know.
Yes,
I do feel like I was able to present a genuine informed curiosity about this topic. And I think that's informed curiosity is, I think, exactly what a lot of committees are looking for when they're reading your proposal.
Excellent. Yeah, that's a great word right there. That's a great for listeners who are trying to sort this one out. What are you genuinely curious about, and what have you been interested in for a while? And I wouldn't be posturing a dissertation proposal, but to draw on what's kind of in your gut, as it were, not just something you've figured out in your head. That also will give you the staying power on the topic.
Right. I hope so.
Because it will get more complicated and more of a dead end before it opens up into the clear path towards the awarding of the degree. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it'll get the green pastures of an original contribution.
That's it. There it is.
Get over the hill first.
Hey, to close, Zach, what are you most excited about in this transition, and what are you most anxious about?
I'm excited about Oxford. I mean,
beautiful city.
Incredible. Beautiful city, and it's the oldest English speaking university in the world. I mean, there's so much to be excited about.
Yeah.
The family adventure of the whole thing. Like, let's, you know, there's a romance in the kind of generic sense, yeah, and then a romance in the relational sense,
yes,
with moving to England. It's just exciting. You know, all the historical connections to Gerald Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and a million other people could be named, you know, translating the first English Bibles in Oxford.
It goes on and on.
You just can't stop. What I'm most excited about is that it's Oxford. That's just going to be incredible. What I'm most anxious about is that it's Oxford. Especially for me, having not been in school for a few years now and having to, like, you know, it's on my transcript that I know German, but, you know, hopefully won't listen to this and hear me say that I know very little German.
He'll be sprechen some Deutsch with you, and it might get a little exciting.
So things like that, brushing up on my languages, and I know it's going to be really hitting the ground running from day one on just, you know, whatever, firing on all cylinders, whatever metaphor you want to slot in there. I think that's intimidating, but also exciting. And there's some anxiety about doing this in the middle of a pandemic. I mean, Oxford is maintaining the residency requirements for all students, but some of it will likely be, remote or over Zoom, even though we'll be in the city. So I'm hoping that doesn't make it significantly more difficult than it already would be. So I'm excited because it's Oxford, and I'm anxious because it's Oxford.
Well, I'm excited for you, brother. This has been fun to watch the journey unfold over the last couple of years, and I've had a upfront and personal seat watching it unfold. It's been encouraging and exciting. I appreciate the way you've navigated and the way you've thought it through and prayed it through. And I'm also glad we get to keep our hooks in you. As I said at the outset, the CPT is not losing Zach Wagner as a friend and partner and an asset. Everyone will be pleased to know you're going to continue to help give some leadership to our resource hub, our website, and to be part of the podcast. They're going to keep hearing your voice on podcast episodes, which is great. And we will look forward to benefiting from everything that you're learning over these next couple of years as well, man. So thanks for sharing. This has been a great tour of your life and journey, and I know it's going to be instructive and helpful for our listeners as well.
Great. Thanks, Todd. Thank you for listening to this episode of the CPT Podcast, a theology podcast for the church. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider throwing us a like, sharing the podcast online, subscribing, leaving a review. Anything like that would go a long way towards helping other people hear about the podcast. The CPT Podcast is a ministry of the Center for Pastor Theologians. You can learn more about the CPT by visiting us at pastortheologians.com. You can also find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our host for today's episode was Todd Wilson. Our producer and editor was Trenton Jones. Our music was composed by Andrew Gerlicher. I'm Zach Wagner. Thanks for listening.